This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2011 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're on Kaurna land and Uncle Lewis will do the welcome to country.
Marawichanga, Kaurna mia na nai wangani, mani te puni ka ni atana. Nai biriko, mankalankalat, tandanya mayanaku. Nai chau yungandalia, nai chau yakanandalia, padni adlu wadu. On behalf of the Kaurna people, I welcome you all to Kaurna country, and I do this ambassador of the Adelaide Plains people. My brothers, my sisters, let's walk together in harmony. There was a young lad proposed to a girl, and she turned him down. He lived happily ever after.
Well, having set a standard of charming informality, I think we'll maintain that in the proceedings tonight. So I will not read you the immense CV of Professor Michael Barber. My excuses, he was saying backstage that the best speech is a short speech, and I think that is probably appropriate to introductions. But Michael has got more academic gongs than you've had hot breakfasts, and he's a star. For example, I will read this because I was very impressed. He got a PhD from Cornell in the field of theoretical physics in 1972. And, of course, theoretical physics only began, I think, in 1971. Please, Michael.
Thank you, Philip. Actually, it is quite good to be a physicist and identified with a physicist in a time when Australia has just won a Nobel Prize in physics by a close friend of mine, Brian Schmidt, at the ANU. So I do think, in fact, to be classified among a physicist, if nowhere near the stature of Brian. Premier and Mrs. Sasha Caruzio, Mayor Felicity Ann Lewis, Mayor of the City of Marion, Associate Professor Robert Fidian, Chair Adelaide Festival of Ideas, Dr. Barbara Hardy, to whom this Adelaide Festival of Ideas is dedicated, Sandy Vashore, Executive Producer Adelaide Festival Ideas, Deputy Chancellor Mr. Ian Yates of Flinders University, Emeritus Chancellor Sir Eric Neal and Lady Neal, former Vice Chancellor Emeritus Professor Anne Edwards, former Deputy Chancellor, Chancellors Dr. Ian Chesterman and Dr. Judith Roberts, Council members, members of the staff of Flinders University, distinguished guests, members of Adelaide, everybody, welcome here this evening. It's a great pleasure for Flinders University, for the first time, to have its preeminent public lecture, the Investigator Lecture, co-branded and part of the Adelaide Festival of Ideas. It is even greater pleasure for Flinders University to have as the speaker this evening the Honourable Mike Rann, Premier of South Australia. As everyone knows, Mike is coming towards the end of, in fact, a remarkable period of transformation in South Australia. And actually looking back on the speakers that we've had here in the Investigator Lecture, and of course the Investigator Lecture, Flinders' preeminent lecture, commemorates the name of Flinders' boat, the Investigator, that circumnavigated Australia. It is quite remarkable how many of them have picked up on that theme of change, of exploration, that resonates with that motif, metaphor, if you like, of the Investigator. Bob Hawke, in 1981, Australia Ahead, Navigational Arts for an Uncertain Future. Bob Brown, a rather younger member, in 1986, The Politics of Conservation in the 1980s and Beyond. Geoffrey Robertson, in 1988, The Freedom to Innovate. And Peter Carmel, who actually is twice both giving the inaugural lecture and in 1986, Australia and the Economic Paradigm, 50 Years of Change. And of course, with distinguished overseas people such as Lekwawensa, who talked about the future of democracy in a globalising world in 2003. So tonight, the Premier, in speaking about the charting a course for change, the politics of progress, I think lives up both to being a particular theme resonating with the Investigator and Matthew Flinders' change of Australia, but also, I think, a very fitting speaker of which Flinders is very proud, Premier, to add you to the list of the Investigator lecturers. So we look forward to hearing your words during the evening. Thank you very much.
I'm here with very mixed feelings. I'm not really here to introduce Mike to you. I think most of you are quite familiar with him. I'm here to publicly and personally say goodbye to him in his role as Premier. I wish I could be around next week, where I think his last major official function is to cut the ribbon at the new South Australian Film Corporation facilities, which by all accounts are stunning. That would be an appropriate place for me to be, because I was first introduced to this state and this city by Don Dunstan, and Don and I cooked up the SAFC together. Like so many ideas, began in Adelaide, taken up everywhere. Every premier had to have one within about 10 minutes. But South Australia's has remained the big success story of all of them. Now, many years ago, I was given a dazzling piece of political insight by a very eccentric, in fact, quite dotty, old figure in the British Labour Party. He was a burr under the saddle, a pea beneath the sheets of many a Labour leader. Most recently, he drove Tony Blair mad. His name is Tony Benn. Tony was born to very high place in the aristocracy. I think he was a Viscount, as I understand, but he chucked it away to become a bother boy on behalf of the working class. And he was telling me that every politician in history, irrespective of country, irrespective of time, of gender, of ideology, every single politician came in one of three categories: the straight men, the fixers, and the maddies. Now, it's a wonderful game to play, isn't it? Putting them in the categories. Bob Hawke, classic fixer. And let it be said that politicians in each of those categories can be incredibly successful and significant. It's not, in any sense, a pejorative listing. When I described Paul Keating as a maddie, he was in the lodge at the time, he rang me at the farm and said, "G'day, it's your mad mate here." He was thrilled to bits to be seen as a maddie because, as Ben points out, it's the maddies who dare to change things, for good or ill. Well, other maddies, Thatcher, Reagan, you know, the list goes on. Certain premiers of Victoria who shall remain nameless, like Jeff Kennett. There's a lot of, of people around who are clearly political maddies. And they leave their mark behind them. Straight men, a straight politician, and there's quite a lot who have been absolutely straight up and down, can be good administrators, can run a safe ship. If you look at the American presidential system, I suppose a straight was Eisenhower. You know, nothing much happened on Dwight D. Eisenhower's watch. Fixer, the great American fixer, although he wasn't very good at fixing things, was Bill Clinton, who was so like Hawke in so many ways. Then, of course, I spent a few days with Mikhail Gorbachev, and he kept reminding me of someone. I was trying to work out, you know, which category he was in. And suddenly I realised he reminded me of Graham Richardson, because Mikhail was a fixer. Now, he happened to drop the Soviet Union, fell into pieces, but basically that was his instinct, that was his skill. Now, I try to work out where to put Mike Rann. And I suddenly realise, where are you, Michael? I suddenly realise that Mike ticks all the boxes. A very rare combination of skills. First of all, Mike looks wonderfully straight when he comes up here, impeccably groomed. He just looks the part. The fact that he's been Premier this bloody long and party leader for such an immense stretch of time, and he's kept the state afloat and heading in the right direction, shows that his fixing skills are very important. Once again, terribly important areas. Straight, fixer. But he's also a maddie. He's picked up where the tick one box, Don Dunstan, left off. Don was wonderfully mad, wonderfully creatively mad, daring. hardly a day passed when he didn't do something extraordinary, and a high percentage of the things he did paid off. Well, Mike picked up the torch from Don, and I've watched this bloke for many, many years being ticking those boxes and keeping all those things in balance. But it is the Maddie in him that I want to salute very briefly tonight. This guy has turned Adelaide into an ongoing festival of ideas, not just one that's held every couple of years where we all rock along to hear some important people. He's made Adelaide a sort of huge think tank. It's no accident that many, many innovations, social innovations of one sort or another, social inclusion policies, have been trialled in the state. This is the state that had thinkers in residence. This is the state that is festooned with festivals. And I tell you what, you're going to miss him when he's gone. That's one of the... And how few politicians can one really say that of? Mike, it's been a privilege to know you, an honour to work with you from time to time. I think you tick all the boxes, and I know this is a farewell in one stage of your life. I'm sure our paths will cross again and again and again as your energies are unleashed by retirement. And, wait for it. He'll pop up all over the planet, I think, because a lot of other people share my respect for him. Ladies and gentlemen, the outgoing but irreplaceable Premier of South Australia, Mike Rann.
Thank you very much, Philip, to so many leaders in this room, but I want to particularly mention former Chancellor and Governor of South Australia, Sir Eric Neil and Lady Neil, and to the Vice-Chancellor, Michael Barber, to Sandy Vershaw, who's the Executive Producer of the Adelaide Festival of Ideas, and what a great, great program this year. And also, can I say to one of our great partners in thinking and ideas, who's really been, I think, in terms of the government, the great prodder along of ideas, and that's Greg Mackey. To tonight's MC, Philip Adams, special guests, ladies and gentlemen, I want to say thank you to Uncle Lewis for his generous welcome to country, and that we also acknowledge that we meet on the traditional lands of the Kaurna people and that we respect their deep spiritual relationship with their country. Well, I'm delighted to be here and have the opportunity to draw the curtain on what's been another fascinating and thought-provoking festival of ideas. So congratulations to Sandy and her team and to everyone involved in pulling together and delivering this year's program. It's also an honour to be invited to deliver the Flinders University Investigator Lecture. And as you've heard, the lecture series has over the years seen an imposing and diverse array of speakers since it was inaugurated in 1979 to reflect Flinders University's strong commitment to knowledge and community engagement. In fact, I remember my first visit to Flinders University was as an advisor to Don Dunstan, and there was a demonstration, and Don leapt out of the car, opened the boot, there was a megaphone in the boot, and then he sort of addressed, some might say, dressed down the demonstrators for being so ungrateful, and then went to open a new wing at the Flinders Medical Centre. But obviously people like Bob Hawke and Pat O'Shane, Robin Archer, and also amongst the esteemed roll call is Justice Michael Kirby, who presented the second investigator lecture in his role as chairman of the Australian Law Reform Commission. And former High Court Justice Kirby and law reform are topics that I will return to later in this evening's address. His speech was delivered in 1980, the year after Don Dunstan had stepped down as Premier of South Australia. And it marked the end of an era when our state was renowned not only for its preparedness to embrace ideas and reform, but for its capacity to transform them into practical reforms. And it was an exciting time to be here. Indeed, many people moved to South Australia from other states and around the world to be part of the Dunstan vision, and I was one of them. The groundswell for change was partly a response to the times. South Australia had emerged restless from decades of staid and stifled conservatism. The dam had to burst. But the zeitgeist of those days was also largely due to the energy and purpose of Don Dunstan, a man of incredible reformist zeal, but also an unyielding political pragmatist. Don knew there was no point of being an architect of reform if you weren't prepared to get out and sell it as well, and then to deliver those reforms by being elected, being re-elected, and being re-elected again to ensure that they were embedded. He understood the enduring truism that change is always harder to pitch than the comfortable status quo. And he always said, and he must have said this in front of me hundreds of times, that it was really important for all of us to always question our own long-held and most deepest-held assumptions in the quest to do things better. It was a conviction that drove the pioneering achievements that came to characterise South Australia in the 1970s, the first state to grant Aboriginal land rights, with legislation that was passed before the historic 1967 federal referendum. We became the template for modern multiculturalism that celebrates diversity in background, opinion, and very importantly, in faith, as well as in lifestyle and cuisine. A trailblazer in the fight for equal rights for women, by no means a certainty in those days, and a proud leader in the equality of civil liberties for our gay and lesbian community, striking a crucial first blow against the blinkered fears that always find refuge within prejudice and ignorance. The decriminalisation of homosexuality in 1975 came more than 3 years after the drowning murder of Adelaide University law lecturer George Duncan in the River Torrens. Even though our state became the first to fully decriminalise homosexuality, the South Australian Police Special Branch, under former Commissioner Harold Salisbury, continued to maintain pink files on suspected homosexuals, even though homosexuality was legal, which exemplifies that sometimes a change in attitude follows rather than leads to a change in the law. It was that willingness to see an idea through to its destination that led many to reflect on that period as a golden era of social and legal reform. But unlike safari suits, ideas should not remain confined to specific historical epochs and fashions. They can thrive perennially, provided that they're carefully sown and nurtured. And Don's legacy was for us to continually look forward rather than look back with rose-tinted glasses on former glories. He would have hated that. And that's why upon coming to office in 2002, our government committed itself to cultivating new ideas so that South Australia could once again innovate and lead, to show that you could be pro-environment, pro-social justice, and pro-business and jobs at the same time. Now, in recent speeches, including the recent Hawke lecture, I've detailed the unprecedented investment the government is making in physical infrastructure and economic development. This evening, I want to speak of an area that might not be so immediately obvious, but is no less significant in securing our future prosperity, the commitment we're making to build intellectual infrastructure in this state, to build intellectual capital, the foundation stones upon which this century's progress will be built. Perhaps because we can't see these constructs taking shape from car windows or from the top of Mount Lofty, many of these important initiatives are overlooked, or in the case of those we moved quickly to introduce upon coming to office, simply forgotten in the churn of the electoral and the daily news cycles. But it's worth revisiting some of them and reminding ourselves of the strategic and long-term value they offer. Recognising that South Australia has a proud history as a centre for learning excellence, one third of our nation's Nobel laureates have studied or worked here, we set about building Adelaide's reputation as a university city. Because in terms of its size and its layout, Adelaide could double as a purpose-built campus, as well as the best place to stage festivals. Everything an inquiring mind might crave, a library, a museum, gallery, the festival centre, located within a minute's walk. So to complement the outstanding work and reputations of our existing universities, Flinders and Adelaide and UniSA, we went out to attract prestigious international institutions that offered specially tailored courses. For example, Carnegie Mellon's University's Masters of Science degrees in Information Technology and in Public Policy and Management, an area in which it's working very closely with Flinders. And University College London's School of Energy and Resources, working collaboratively and with the multi-million dollar support of Santos and BHP Billiton to train local and international students for careers in our mining and energy industries. We also moved early to enhance our state's reputation for delivering innovative solutions to the challenges of food production by establishing the Australian Centre for Plant Functional Genomics at Adelaide University's Waite campus. And this facility hosts world-leading research. It's rated in the top three in the world into our essential cereal crops with the aim of developing improved varieties of wheat and barley that are better able to withstand stresses such as drought and salinity, as well as further improving yield and quality in a future of climate change. Opened in 2004, this centre has since been complemented by the $25 million Adelaide Plant Accelerator, or Super Greenhouse, as it's known, also located at the Waite. And more recently, we've invested in the Mawson Institute of Advanced Manufacturing at UniSA's Mawson Lakes campus. Went there recently to open it, and I'm amazed that they're manufacturing skin for to treat people who are burns victims. Investing in innovation is vital to ensuring that our state's manufacturing industry remains resilient and globally competitive. And that's why we've acquired the former Mitsubishi manufacturing site at Tonsley Park, which will be transformed into a sustainability hub, delivering the clean tech skills and the industries that will underpin our green future. It'll be the first of its kind in Australia. And I'm delighted that Flinders, as well as TAFE, will be foundation tenants. We're establishing the most advanced, efficient and sustainable hospital in Australia. And just excitingly is the facility that's already taking shape alongside the new RAH, the South Australian Health and Medical Research Institute, which will house almost 700 health and medical researchers. It's the same level of intellectual symbiosis and value-adding that we're seeing at Flinders, where the close collaboration between your university and the medical centre is growing to include the new Flinders Centre for Innovation in Cancer, which incorporates the Livestrong Cancer Research Centre. And this integrated facility that will be in constant flow of contact and intellectual property with the Livestrong Centre in Austin, Texas, will lead Australia in pioneering the early diagnosis, prevention, treatment, survivability and support for people with cancer. But our commitment to ideas has not been restricted to knowledge for its own sake. As President Kennedy said, a rising tide lifts all boats. So we've confronted our state's most glaring inequalities, the kind of complex social issues that demand bold thinking as well as quick action. And even though, as I mentioned earlier, we were the first state to formally recognise Aboriginal land rights, and more recently the first state parliament to apologise to the stolen generation, we also recognise that too often the first Australians were the last Australians on so many social indicators. We've worked hard to address the inequity suffered by Aboriginal South Australians, and we continue to do that right now, and I mean right now, in our negotiations with mining companies in terms of future jobs. But no one pretends there's a quick fix. In 2004, we intervened in a completely different way to enforce the law in the APY lands in our states far north, to ensure democratic elections that were provided for in Don Dunstan's bill but were being ignored, to save the lives of young Anangu who were at risk of violence, child abuse, alcoholism and petrol sniffing. By doing so, I was accused of being a racist. I was likened to Zimbabwean dictator Robert Mugabe. But at the same time, there was not a single police officer based in the lands, and now there are more than 20. There was no TAFE, but there is now. We funded highly successful arts centres to provide an income as well as continuity of culture. We invested tens of millions of dollars to reticulate electricity for the first time, and we're investing strongly in new housing. We've built new schools, learning and family centres, as well as a new school for the Oak Valley community, one of the state's most isolated in the Maralinga lands, and constructed swimming pools at Armitage and Mimile as part of our no school, no pool policy to dramatically improve school attendance. And also, in 2004, I travelled to the Western Australian border for the handover of the 21,000 square kilometre, then known as the Unnamed Conservation Park, to its traditional Maralinga Jarata owners. It was the first handback of land to Aboriginal owners since the previous Labor administration, in which I was Minister for Aboriginal Affairs, when we handed over the Aldea lands in 1991. Of course, there is much, much more to be done, both on the ground and across the board, to again set the pace for Australia. Indeed, I believe an important step will be the recognition of Aboriginal people in the preamble to South Australia's constitution, an acknowledgement that I also hope will be adopted federally. It will provide recognition, long overdue, of those whose contact with the land has been perpetual, abiding and enduring. There are other areas of reform we embarked upon as a matter of urgency to try and restore South Australia's standing as a progressive, innovative state. Honouring the strong representations we'd received from women's groups, we undertook the biggest changes to our state's rape and sexual assault laws in more than 30 years. We also, as a matter of priority, reformed South Australia's once progressive but since outdated sexual discrimination statutes. And that included changing more than 90 laws to give same-sex couples equality in matters relating to property, superannuation, benefits and compensation. In other words, the same recognition that's enjoyed as a civil right by heterosexual de facto couples. But while such initiatives were essential to overdue change, the government accepted that we do not hold a monopoly of wisdom or ideas. Indeed, we actively sought the input, the advice and the judgment of individuals and organisations throughout South Australia and beyond. In formulating South Australia's strategic plan about where we want to go as a state within 10 or 20 years and how we're going to get there, we've engaged in some of the largest public consultation exercises that South Australia has seen. This provided neighbourhoods and communities, individuals and families, the chance to be consulted and heard about how they wanted their state to evolve. But we also had to accept that the challenges we face are rarely geographically unique. And that's why we've consciously sought out the best ideas from around the world and shown that we're prepared to adopt or to adapt that wisdom, the ideas that work wherever they come from, which is how I attended this very festival over a decade ago. The idea for the Adelaide Thinkers in Residence program was born, an initiative that has since 2003 delivered some remarkable and profound successes, that secured investment worth hundreds of millions of dollars and prompted many, many changes to legislation. Now, like so many worthwhile ideas, our Thinkers Initiative has also attracted its share of controversy. Of course, the debate and the critique of ideas is healthy, it's essential. And thank God that Australia has Philip Adams and national forums like ABC Radio National for the airing of considered, constructive, and contentious opinions. But some of our more parochial commentators still cannot see the point in bringing world-class minds to work with us in our community, to challenge our politicians, including me, to do better, to collaborate with our public sector, universities and business leaders, to attend cabinet meetings, run policy lectures, engage in dialogue with the wider public on some of the great issues facing us. As one local talkback host said, I want to quote, I'm not saying it's not a worthwhile program, I'm just saying, would anyone shed a tear if we stopped bringing out academics from overseas to think here? So this idea of a sort of a Rodin pose. I phoned the commentator and said, you keep attacking thinkers in residence, but you're the biggest user of thinkers in residence in terms of interviews. And his reply was, I love the thinkers, I just can't stand the program, even though the thinkers are the program. So surely the time has arrived to shake off these narrow insecurities, to stop pretending that we know the answer to everything, while at the same time lamenting that the grass is forever greener elsewhere. Whether it's safeguarding the health of our environment, exploring the latest thinking in early childhood development, or shaping policies to tackle some of our most intractable social problems, it makes sense, practical sense, to seek out the very best global experts and apply their expertise to our particular circumstances. And we've seen over the course of 8 years and more than 20 thinkers how some truly inspiring and innovative ideas have taken shape. Beginning with Herbert Girardet, whose inaugural residency entitled Making Adelaide a Green City has quite literally taken root. He recommended we plant native trees and plant plants around the city to lower our carbon footprint, reduce soil erosion and increase biodiversity. So we've nearly completed planting 3 million seedlings across Adelaide in a series of urban forests. But that led to me in my role as chair internationally of the Climate Group, which has about 72 states, subnational governments around the world, to propose that all of us do the same thing, that we plant 1 billion trees internationally. If there wasn't leadership from national governments at Copenhagen, and this is where it took place, that we would lead, that we would collectively, very diverse states, plant 1 billion trees. Well, so far, there's been a commitment to plant 350 million trees, with my friend, the Premier of Quebec, pledging 100 million trees to be planted, then to be matched by the First Minister of Scotland. So again, a thinker in residence comes here, the idea is planted here and then is taken up internationally. And Herbert also inspired our solar feed-in scheme and our nation-leading embrace of renewable energy. And Herbert has been here over the weekend, and it was great to catch up with him at a Thinkers Return public event last week. Like me, he's advocating that the next key step in our battle against climate change is ecological sequestration. Up until now, the focus has been on geological sequestrations, storing CO2 underground in giant cavities left by mining or oil and gas. But significant advances are being made into sequestering CO2 into soil, which helps to enhance the quality of farming land as well as cut down the level of greenhouse gases in our atmosphere. This technology offers great opportunities for our planet and for our economy, and I can think of no better testbed for this innovative idea than here in a dry state like South Australia. Then there's the work of the late Peter Cullen, which gave us the intellectual firepower prior to the drought to put the rescue of the Murray-Darling Basin on the national agenda. Peter also advocated the development of a desalination as an integral element in drought-proofing this city, but with our desal plant, I'm very proud to say, being 100% powered by renewable energy, the only one I know of in the world. And this is where the real value of our Thinkers program lies. It does not cultivate theories hatched in academic isolation. It requires our thinkers to get out and about, to collaborate with local partners, to see for themselves the lie of the land, and to publicly challenge prevailing wisdom and policies, as US Judge Peggy Hora recently did with me and the government on a number of law and order issues. That's good. That's healthy. Another key criterion for our thinkers is how their work can dovetail into other residencies. For example, Fred Hansen's insights, even before he arrived here as one of our thinkers, led to the electrification of our trains, the extension of our tram line, not only to deliver better public transport, but to generate economic activity along these transit corridors. He said, take it west, you'll see a regeneration as they did in Portland, Oregon. And he also stressed the importance of bike and walking paths and to promote even greater cycling and pedestrian culture that in turn develops a stronger sense of community. And Fred's work fits closely with the residency of Professor Laura Lee, who's challenged us to do better on planning and architecture, to foster a richer design culture in our state, not just to look at the design of buildings, but the spaces between, to stop our fragmented ad hoc approach to infrastructure, and to reap the rewards of a more intelligent investment in design. As a result of her work, we've established the Integrated Design Commission, and among other projects, the Commission has responsibility for the master plan that will reinvigorate the precinct, Riverbank and North Terrace precinct that stretches from Hackney all the way through to the new billion-dollar Bowden Village development, of course, obviously including a major upgrade of the Adelaide Festival Centre as its heart, because it's so important to the cultural pulse of our state. Not only will this become one of the outstanding cultural boulevards of the world, just as important, it will stand as a great legacy of integrated design and provide a template for other states and cities to employ, backed by an enthusiastic Commonwealth government. In his final report, another thinker, a great environmentalist, the late Stephen Schneider, who, of course, along with Al Gore and others, won the Nobel Prize for his work on climate change. He noted that the thinking in South Australia on climate change science and policy and sustainability is some of the most conceptually advanced, he said, that he'd come across anywhere in the world. By building on his recommendations, we've been able to establish South Australia as by far the nation's biggest source of wind power, and a national leader in tackling climate change. We have 7.2% of the population, 54% of the nation's wind power. We easily lead in solar power. We easily lead in the development of geothermal. We hit the federal government's target of 20% of our power coming from renewables 9 years ahead of schedule. Similarly, Baroness Professor Greenfield's extraordinarily productive residency led to a raft of initiatives designed to help lift the scientific literacy of our community and its decision makers, as well as encourage young people to embrace careers in science, to help further position our state as an intellectual hub. Not only did Susan's play a key role in Adelaide securing the Royal Institution Australia, RIOS, the only operation of the distinguished Royal Institution of Great Britain to be established outside the UK, but located within the RIOS building in the former Adelaide Stock Exchange, and if you haven't seen it, it's the most beautiful restoration, as well as being the most high-tech space in our city, is one of her residence's great success stories. The Australian Science Media Centre ensures our national science community has a strong presence in the major news issues of the day by putting journalists directly in touch with our foremost scientific thinkers. The OzSMC works with close to 800 registered journalists from around Australia and internationally and has established a database of nearly 3,000 media-savvy scientists. Since it opened 6 years ago, the centre has handled more than 6,300 media inquiries, and now a series of similar initiatives are being based on it in Japan, Canada, New Zealand and Denmark, with another group of countries to come. However, our Thinkers program is not designed exclusively for the upper range of the learning spectrum. It's also committed to ensuring school age and even younger children to receive the encouragement and the opportunities they need to grow ideas, to reach their potential, through programs such as our Every Chance for Every Child initiative, or the Premier's Reading Challenge that continues to generate more positive feedback than any other program that I've been involved with. And that's why our next two thinkers will be an expert in the field of positive psychology, with a strong emphasis on children's well-being, and also a leader in the innovative educational philosophy of Reggio Emilia, regarded as the leader in the world in early childhood education, a program that promotes learning through the development of the full range of a child's communication, expression, cognitive and imaginative skills. In addition to help formulate better policies and programs, our thinkers in residence have offered fresh perspectives to tackle complex social problems. Roseanne Haggerty's response to the problem of homelessness has resulted in the acclaimed Common Ground Initiative, which provides affordable accommodation and support services to people on low incomes and those who are homeless or at risk of becoming homeless. The success of her program here has seen it already adopted now in other states. And I always remember when Roseanne showed me around a once derelict skyscraper hotel in New York City's Times Square district that had been renovated through the Common Ground program. One of the most impressive, inspiring projects I've seen, turning around the lives of people grappling with alcoholism, drug abuse, mental illness and poverty. And a street-to-home program that we've adopted here targets rough sleepers in the city and provides them with access to stable and secure housing. Among them are people who have been sleeping rough in the parklands and elsewhere for between 5 and 15 years, and who faced every level of degradation but are now being accepted into TAFE courses, into universities, into jobs. And Vice Chancellor, it was wonderful to meet a young woman who had been homeless in our city, sleeping rough, who's just completed 2 degrees at Flinders University and is now enrolled in a PhD program with Flinders. These programs stand as central pillars of our social inclusion initiative. And complementing Roseanne Haggerty's work was Jeff Mulgan, who describes South Australia as a place where the future happens first. And among the projects to have developed from Jeff's residency is the Australian Centre for Social Innovation, whose underlying philosophy is to turn bold ideas into better lives. As Jeff noted in his final report, the time is ripe to bring energy and commitment to innovation in the social field, and South Australia is ideally placed to again be a leader. And when I first announced the proposed Centre for Social Innovation in 2008, I indicated that a prominent Australian would be appointed as its inaugural chair. And true to my word, Philip Adams was chosen to fill that role. And a fantastic job he has done. I also asked Justice Michael Kirby, who was about to retire from the bench of the High Court, to join the board. I've been an admirer of Michael Kirby's since the evening in 1978 when I shared a car ride from Newcastle to Sydney with him and with Don Dunstan. It was immediately after Don had delivered his passionate and influential lecture on women's rights at the University of Newcastle. And during that couple of hours' return to Sydney, Michael and Don in the back, me in the front with the driver listening, but they engaged in a fascinating, wide-ranging discussion that centred largely on the issue of rights, women's rights, Aboriginal rights, homosexual rights. I can recall sitting and listening in quiet awe as these two incisive minds explored ideas. I remember thinking to myself, if only this had been recorded to be broadcast to a wider audience. The words of Don's Newcastle lecture returned to me recently when I read an extract of Michael Kirby's autobiography, in particular the sections where he writes about the legal recognition that continues to be denied homosexual couples in Australia. And I recall Don's speech in which he noted, I want to quote, "To treat women as lesser beings in law, education, or employment is to diminish us as a society. It's a statement that continues to apply to any group denied equality." So I want to take this opportunity this evening to support the views of Michael Kirby in the spirit of that conversation which I overheard more than 30 years ago, to add my voice to those calling for homosexual couples to have the legal right to marry, so that we're no longer diminished as a society. For the Commonwealth Parliament to amend the Marriage Act to remove the final barrier to full legal equality for same-sex partners, and by doing so to protect Australia's proud reputation as a forward-thinking, tolerant, and diverse nation. It is time that we recognise the validity of all genuine long-term relationships. This must be through the institution of marriage at a federal level, rather than the halfway house of civil unions, as recently introduced in some other states, as well as in New Zealand and the UK. These civil unions stand as the more timid solution to the issue of same-sex relationships, the escape clause for those who want to see marriage reserved exclusively for relationships between a man and a woman. Now, to be fair, these civil unions confer many of the rights of marriage, but they take place under separate legislation, not the Commonwealth Marriage Act. Critics of civil unions, in my view, rightly argue that rather than afford the same recognition and security as marriage, they're instead a second-class institution and are viewed as inferior or not recognised at all by the wider community. Now, I certainly respect people who hold different views, and I understand there are those who believe that the Marriage Act is sacrosanct, given that it enshrines the long-held view of marriage existing only between a man and a woman. But we've seen changes to marriage in the past. For example, in a number of Australian jurisdictions, not that long ago, marriage between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people was deemed illegal unless written permission was received from a high office such as the Chief Protector of Aborigines. A marriage used to act as an impediment or even to remove a woman's right to hold property or to engage in specific employment. Till as recently as the 1960s and 70s, women working in some parts of the state and federal public service had to resign when they were married. Same-sex marriage is now legal in a dozen or more countries, many of them nations that have not previously been renowned as flying the flag for civil libertarianism. In addition to the accepted trailblazers of the Netherlands or Scandinavian nations or Canada, same-sex marriage is now enshrined by law in Catholic Spain, Argentina, in South Africa, and legislation is imminent in Slovenia, Paraguay, and even Nepal. Here in South Australia, despite the laws we introduced to deliver greater equality for same-sex relationships, our domestic partnership agreements available to same-sex couples are not marriage. And while I applaud the federal Labor government for amending more than 80 pieces of legislation to remove discrimination against same-sex couples and for recognising civil unions, in my view, this does not go far enough. It is quite simply unfair to prevent same-sex couples from having their relationship, a union that is viewed as equal in every other aspect of the law, being recognised as a legal marriage. It only serves to undermine the legitimacy of their relationship and their family. Same-sex marriages is an idea whose time has well and truly arrived in mature, diverse 21st century Australia. So what about it is so threatening? What about it makes some people so fearful, so insecure? Now, I'll leave the final word on this subject to Michael Kirby, who so poignantly prosecutes the case in his book. Quote, "Denying equality in a matter that concerns the dignity and respect due to precious long-term relationships is hurtful and against society's interest. Money, he says, is not enough. Dignity, recognition, and acceptance are precious in their own right." Ladies and gentlemen, in wrapping up a lecture that I delivered at this venue last month, I foreshadowed that I believe South Australia now stands poised for greatness, as was the case in the 1970s when we were the talk of the nation. We're embarking on an exciting era for our state, and we will take that decisive step up to greatness if we continue to embrace new ideas with imagination and vision, if we take the risks associated with being a leader rather than remaining a follower. But to achieve those gains, we have to continually defeat those who find comfort in whining about inaction one minute, only to furiously resist any attempts at change the next. We cannot let the relentless local clobbering machine run by minority vested interests to force South Australia to retreat once more into quiet complacency or to accept genteel decline. Throughout its history, South Australia has oscillated between a warm embrace of reform and a cold disdain for change. It's time to recognise the power of ideas, ideas that challenge us rather than comfort us, that will propel us forward by choice, not by chance. Thank you very much for listening tonight. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Premier. I will not try to pick up from Philip Adams and put you in one of his boxes or in all three boxes. What I will do in bringing this investigator lecture for 2011 to a close is hark back to the beginning of the 19th century, back to that little boat that is on the Flinders Crest. In those days, one of the debating issues of Australia was, where was Australia a single island continent? After the investigator voyage, that question was answered. Australia was very different. We had, for the first time as a nation, well, we were not yet to be a nation, but we had in fact become a continent. It is said of leadership, if you can leave some legacy that will in fact last well beyond you, you have succeeded as a leader. I think we can testify to the fact on both of those analogies. Firstly, like investigator, you have left South Australia different than it was when you took office. And with the challenges that you have thrown out through particularly the Thinkers program, you've changed public policy both here in South Australia and in Australia. I think from now, 30 years in advance, when we look back, when the hurly-burly of the 24-hour media cycle and the hurly-burly of politics has receded, I think your legacy for South Australia will in fact put you up with many of the great transformers of this age. I'm a relative newcomer to South Australia, been here just over 3 years. I came in part because I was in fact attracted by the challenge of leading a university in a nation, in a state that was under quite immense change. And I can see that change about us every day in the students that we bring in and the challenges we face. But I also believe that South Australia is sitting at a cusp, and I think the challenge for us in picking up that legacy is to ensure that we continue to reform, we continue to welcome ideas in, and we don't hesitate to be bold, both in the sense of Matthew Flinders and the investigator, and also in the sense of Don Dunstan and the legacy of Mike Rann now that has led forward. So, Premier, can I thank you on behalf of the audience here and on behalf of Flinders University for giving the 2011 investigator lecture. Thank you. And there's a slight dip. And that completes the formalities today. And Robert and Sandy, I think, also brings to a conclusion the 2011 Festival of the Ideas. Flinders is proud to be part of that and proud of our 2011 Flinders Lecturer. Thank you very much.
This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2011 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.